The evening before they reached the Portuguese settlement of Lorenzo Marx, on the deep bight of Delagoa Bay, Robin dressed the stitches in Clinton's side, making small cooing and clucking sounds of satisfaction and approval as she saw how cleanly they were healing. When she helped him into his shirt and then buttoned it for him, like a mother dressing her child, he told her gravely, "I am aware you have saved my life." "Even though you do not approve of my methods?" she asked with a twinkle of a smile. "I ask you forgiveness for my impertinence." He dropped his eyes. "You have proved yourself to be a brilliant physician." She made a modest murmur of denial. But when he insisted, "No, I truly mean that. I think you are gifted." Robin protested no further, but moved slightly to make it easier for him to reach her with his good arm. But his declaration of faith in her skills seemed to have exhausted his courage for the moment. That evening she vented some of her frustration by confiding to her journal that Captain Codrington is clearly a man that can be trusted by a woman in any circumstances, though a little more boldness would make him a great deal more attractive. She was about to close the journal and lock it away in her chest when another thought occurred to her, and she thumbed back through the preceding pages, each crammed with her small, neat script, until she reached the single sheet that had become a milestone in her life. The entry for the day before Huron reached Cape Town. She had left it blank. What words were there to describe it? Each moment of it would be engraved forever on her memory. She stared for many minutes at the empty sheet, and then she made a silent calculation, subtracting one date from another. When she had the answer, she felt a chill of foreboding and went over the calculation again, reaching the same answer. She closed the journal slowly and stared at the lantern flame. She had missed her lunar courses by almost a week, and with a prickle of dread lifting the fine hair at the nape of her neck, she laid her hand upon her own belly as if there was something to feel there, like the pistol ball in Clinton's flesh. Black Joe called at Lorenzo Marx for coal bunkers, despite the town's notoriety as a fever port. The swamps and mangroves that half-circled the town to the southwards spread the miasmic airs across the port. Although Robin had only very limited first-hand experience of the peculiar fevers of Africa, she'd made a close study of all the writings on the subject, the most notable of these being probably those of her own father. Fuller Ballantyne had written a long paper for the British Medical Association in which he recognised four distinct types of African fever. The recurrent fevers with a definite cycle he divided into three categories, quotidian, tertian and quartan, by the length of the cycle. These he called the malarial fevers. The fourth type was the black vomit, or the yellow jack. In his own unmistakable style, Fuller Ballantyne had shown that these diseases were neither contagious nor infectious. He had done so by a horrifying but courageous demonstration to a group of sceptical brother physicians at the military hospital at Algoa Bay. While the other physicians watched, he had collected a wine glass of fresh vomit from a victim of the yellowjack. Fuller had toasted them with the awful draught and then drunk it down at a single swallow. His colleagues had waited, with a certain keen anticipation, for his demise, and had some difficulty in hiding their disappointment when he showed no ill effects and set off a week later to walk across Africa. Fuller Ballantyne was a man it was easier to admire than to like. The episode had become part of the legend that surrounded him. In his writings, her father insisted that the disease could only be contracted by breathing the night air of tropical areas, particularly those airs released by swamps or other large bodies of stagnant water. However, some individuals most certainly had a natural resistance to the disease, and this resistance was probably hereditary. He cited the African tribes who lived in known malarial areas, and his own family and that of his wife, who had lived and worked in Africa for 60 years with only mild afflictions. Fuller wrote of the seasoning fever, the first dose of which either killed or gave partial immunity to the subject. He used the example of the high mortality rate amongst newly arrived Europeans in Africa. He quoted the case of Nathaniel Isaacs, who in 1832 left Port Natal in a party with 21 newly arrived white men to hunt hippopotamus in the estuary and swamps of St. Lucia River. Within 4 weeks, 19 had perished, while Isaacs and the other survivor were so racked with the disease that they were invalids for almost a year thereafter. These losses were unnecessary, Fuller Ballantyne pointed out. There was a preventative and a cure that had been known for hundreds of years, though under various names. Peruvian bark, or cinchona bark, more recently called essence of quinine when manufactured in powder form by the Quaker brothers Luke and John Howard. Taken at the dosage of 5 grams daily, it was a highly effective preventative, for even if the disease was subsequently contracted, it was in such mild form as to be no more dangerous than a common cold, and responded immediately to a more massive dose of 25 grains of quinine. Of course, Robin had heard the accusation that her father played down the dangers of the disease to further his grand design. Fuller Ballantyne had a vision of Africa settled by colonists of British stock, bringing to the savage continent the true God and all the benefits of British justice and ingenuity. His catastrophic expedition to the Zambezi had been in pursuit of this vision, for the great river was to have been his highway to the high and healthy plateau of the interior, where his Englishmen would settle, driving out the slavers, bringing the warring and godless tribes to order, and taming and cultivating the savage earth. Part of his vision had died upon the terrible torrents and rapids of the Kabora Bassa Gorge. With a sneaking sensation of disloyalty, Robin admitted to herself that there was probably some shred of justification in the accusation, for she, as a child, had seen her father in the grip of a malarial fever, brought out by the cold of an English winter. It had not seemed as mild as a common cold then. Despite this, there was no one in the medical profession who doubted that Fuller Ballantyne was probably one of the world's leading authorities on the disease, and that he had a real talent in diagnosing and treating it. So she followed his dictates faithfully, administering the daily 5 grains of quinine to herself, to Zuga, and under protest, to Captain Codrington. She had no success with Zuga's Hottentot musketeers, however. At the first dose, Jan Cheroot had begun staggering in circles, clutching his throat and rolling his eyes horribly, crying to all his Hottentot gods that he had been poisoned. Only a tot of ship's rum saved him, but none of the other Hottentots would touch the white powder after that. Not even the thought of a tot of rum would tempt them, which was a measure of their opposition to the cure. Robin could only hope that they possessed the resistance to the fever that her father spoke of. Her store of quinine was meant to last for the duration of the expedition, possibly as long as 2 years. So she had reluctantly to refrain from pressing any of it on Black Joke's seamen. She stilled her conscience with the fact that none of them would be spending a night ashore, therefore they would not be exposed to the dangerous airs. She prevailed upon Clinton Codrington to anchor in the outer roads where the onshore breeze kept the air sweet, and as an added attraction, the distance offshore prevented the swarms of mosquitoes and other flying insects from coming on board during the night. The first night at anchor, the sound of music, of drunken laughter, and the shrill cries of women at play and at work carried across the still waters to the 9 Hottentot musketeers in their corner of the forecastle. The lights of the bordels and bars along the waterfront were as irresistible to the 9 as a candle to a hawk moth. Temptation was made unbearable by the weight and heat of the golden sovereign that each of them carried in some secret place upon his person, the princely advance that Major Ballantyne had made against their salaries. Sergeant Cheroot woke Zuga a little before midnight, his features a mask of outrage. "They are gone," he was shaking with anger. "Where?" Zuga was still more asleep than awake. "They swim like rats," stormed Cheroot. "They all go drinking and whoring." The thought of it was insupportable. "We must catch them. They will burn their brains out on smoke and pox themselves." His rage was mixed with an equal portion of raw envy, and once they were ashore, his enthusiasm for the chase was almost a frenzy. Chirrut had an unerring instinct that led him directly to the lowest dives on the waterfront. "You go in, master," he told Zuga. "I'll wait around the back." And he twitched the short oaken club in his hand with gleeful anticipation. The tobacco smoke and the fumes of cheap rum and gin were like a solid wall, but the musketeer saw Zuga the moment he stooped through the doorway into the yellow lantern light. There were four of them. They overturned two tables and smashed a dozen bottles in their eagerness to depart, jamming in a solid knot in the doorway to the rear alley before bursting out into the night beyond. It took Zuga half a minute to push and wrestle his way through the crowd. The women of a dozen rich shades between gold and ebony reached out to pluck shamelessly at the more private areas of his anatomy as he passed, forcing him to defend himself. And the men deliberately blocked his path until he drew the Colt revolver from under his coattails. Only then they sullenly opened a way for him to pass. When he reached the back door, Sergeant Chirrut had the four Hottentots laid out in a row in the filth and dust of the alley. "You haven't killed them?" Zuga asked anxiously. "Near what? They got heads of solid bone." Chirrut tucked the club back in his belt and stooped to pick up one of the bodies. The strength of his wiry little body was out of all proportion to its size. He carried them down to the beach one at a time, as though they were bags of straw, and dumped them head first into the waiting whaler. "Now we find the others." They ferreted them out singly and in pairs, from the fantan parlours and the gin hells, tracking down the ninth and last to the embrace of an enormous naked Somali lady in one of the shacks of mud walls and corrugated iron roofs behind the waterfront. It was almost dawn when Zuga climbed warily out of the whaler onto Black Joke's deck and booted the ninth Hottentot down the forecastle ladder. He started for his own cabin, red-eyed and irritable, aching with fatigue, when it occurred to him that he had not noticed Sergeant Chirrut amongst the dark figures in the whaler, and his penetrating voice and biting sarcasm had been silent on the return from the beach. Zuga's mood was murderous as he landed once again and picked his way through the narrow, filth-choked alleys to the mud and iron shack. The woman made up four of Jan Chirrut. She was a mountain of polished dark flesh, gleaming with oil, each of her widespread thighs thicker than his waist, her great mammaries each as large as his head, and Jan Chirrut's head was buried between them, as though he was drowning himself in exotic and abundant flesh, so that his ecstatic cries were almost smothered. The woman looked down at him fondly, chuckling to herself as she watched Sergeant Chirrut's upended buttocks. They were skinny and delicate and a shade of buttercup yellow, but they seemed to blur with the speed of movement, and the shock waves they created were transferred into the mountain of flesh beneath him, creating ripples and waves that undulated through the woman's belly and elephantine haunches, travelling up to agitate the pendulous folds that hung from her upper arms, and at last breaking in a wobbling, heaving surf of gleaming black flesh around Sergeant Chirrut's head. On the final return to the gunboat, Sergeant Chirrut sat, a small, dejected figure, in the bows of the whaler, his post-coital tristesse considerably enhanced by the buzzing in his ears and the ache in his head. Only Englishmen had the alarming habit of bunching up a hand suddenly and then hitting you with more effect than a man wielding a club or hurling a brick. Sergeant Chirrut found his respect for his new master increasing daily. "You should be an example to the men," Zuga growled at him as he hoisted him up the ladder by the collar of his uniform jacket.
"I know that, master," Chirrut agreed miserably. "But I was in love."
"Are you still in love?" Zuga demanded harshly.
"No, master. With me, love don't last too long," Chirrut assured him hurriedly.